You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses. Hello and welcome to the Guidepost, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us again. We have been putting out some crazy content lately with our ridiculous shop talk and our rapid reactions to all the stuff with striped bass and you know, we've got a lot in the hopper on fishing economics and aquaculture and all this other stuff. But I got to tell you, on a personal level, this is one that I've been waiting for. You can all breathe a sigh of relief, because I will not be talking a tremendous amount on this one. But this is going to be one of the episodes for Blaine's Game Changer podcast. And we are super fortunate to have someone that is just respected across the board in the industry, who has found their way in this kind of difficult fishing world to be, you know, productive on all fronts. So Blaine works with Hillary Hutchinson at Patagonia and Costa, and through all sorts of, you know, different avenues for conservation and promoting the sport of fly fishing. And boy, we are fortunate to have Hillary on here today. Blaine, thank you for bringing her on.
It's my pleasure, and it's my pleasure to have Hillary on today. She's someone I admire deeply and couldn't be more grateful for her joining us. And we work together closely on several projects throughout the year with some of the brands that we jointly are affiliated with, including Patagonia, which Hillary is kind of the ambassador team, coach for us all. She's herding the cats, as I would like to say. It's like herding cats when you're dealing with anybody that's in the fly fishing world. And so Hillary got that esteemed job. And but we've got to spend some time together over the years, and I really admire her ability to be able to cross over all the different parts of fly fishing. She's an ambassador for the biggest brands in the industry, including Orvis, as you said, Patagonia, Yeti, Costa, and several others. Not only that, Hillary has her own fly shop. She does travel destination stuff, also writes for Fly Fisher Magazine, and works on a lot of conservation stuff, which I think is very important. And Hillary and I have kind of talked back and forth about different things that she sees. And that's one of the things I wanted to have her on here for, because being guides and full-time guides, and I had a shop as well, so there's a lot of things that we have in common. But being a longtime guide in the industry, it's challenging moving forward with the ever-changing landscape that we have. And Hillary and I were talking in a Patagonia meeting recently about that. And so that's one reason I wanted to have Hillary here. I think she's a great spokesperson for not only fly fishing, but the fishing and outdoor community. She does a lot of the Yeti film tour stuff. And she has a background in media. And I would like to talk a little bit about that. I want to say welcome and thank you for being here, Hillary.
Thanks. So, thanks, Blaine.
Yeah, absolutely. So how cold is it out in Montana right now?
Not cold enough. I mean, right now we're just basking in all these reports coming out about another year of low snowpack, unfortunately. So, you know, it one of the things that does around here is it kind of makes your small talk like only centered around, you know, the weather and climate and like all of that stuff. You're in the grocery store, and like, of course, you're going to have like 20 conversations with all the people in the grocery store about, oh, when are we going to get snow? And then suddenly we'll get snow and it's like 40 below, you know, for like a week. And then suddenly it's up to 50 degrees in the middle of January, February. So yeah, we have some wacky conditions here, and it just kind of dominates the conversations around here.
Are y'all going to get any of that that water that California is getting? Is that
the atmospheric river?
Yeah.
We have signs of that, you know, for sure. And it's kind of weird because you have all of these different things coming together where you've got the atmospheric river and the La Nina business going on, but then the overall big, you know, climate change situations that we deal with here, especially in what we call the crown of the continent ecosystem up here in Glacier National Park. So yeah, it's a little bit of a perfect storm with all of those little weather pieces and climate pieces and really understanding the differences between them.
Well, I know that's a challenging thing for you. It's not only just having a shop and trying to navigate through that, but also you were telling me that you've kind of expanded your guiding. Can you talk about that yet? Or is that something you want to hold off?
You mean the outfitting. Yeah. So, I have been guiding at Glacier Anglers and Glacier Raft Company since I think 1993 when I was in high school. And I, you know, I'd quit a bunch of different times and picked up, did other jobs and stuff and kept coming back. I think I let my guide's license expire like 4 different times and kind of kept coming back. And then also I outfitted my own operation too and guide out of my own operation. The reason there's two is just because where I am at Glacier Anglers, it's the Wild and Scenic River Corridor. And so that's a special use permit through the Forest Service. And it's an exclusive outfit on public land in the Bob Marshall Wilderness Complex in the Great Bear Wilderness. And that's kind of like my favorite part of guiding is doing those multi-day wilderness trips up in the upper Middle Fork in the Flathead. So so I've worked at that operation, Glacier Anglers, Glacier Raft Company, since high school. And that outfit, you know, has been a family-owned outfit since 1976. And that family just passed it on to me just this year. So now I'm the outfitter for Montana's largest and oldest river outfit, which is kind of cool and nerve-wracking. But, you know, it's been my baby. That zone has been my baby for, you know, for 30 years. So, so I'm super psyched now to be the outfitter up there. And then I'm still, you know, outfit down lower river on my own shop too. So it's great. Like I've got my shop, but I don't guide for my shop. I guide upriver for the other shop, which can be kind of confusing. But it's just because of Forest Service permitting and that's special use permit for wild and scenic, which is really unique in guiding because the wild and scenic river protections are fewer than 0.25% of the nation's rivers. So when you hear about wild and scenic, that's literally just less than 0.25% of all of the rivers in the U.S. have that protection. And up here, we've got 3. So that's a pretty, that's why we have, you know, we're one of the world's last remaining places to have a relatively intact ecosystem. So in this little nucleus, like in this small zone, we have native and wild cutthroat, which kind of in this day and age is still pretty unheard of. You might have wild fish all over and you might have native fish all over, but to have native and wild fish without having invasive species or without having introduced species in that same zone, that's, you know, that's pretty unique. So the relatively intact ecosystem relatively just comes because we're missing the timber bison up here inside the crown of the continent, which they had back in the day. And we've got some noxious weeds coming off of the Southern Boundaries Railroad track. So a couple of things like that, but pretty much the ecosystem is intact. So that's one of the coolest things for me about guiding up here. So yeah, that was the new news, is that I'm now the outfitter for this outfit I've been at since I was a kid, which is cool.
This is why I have her on here. She's so inspiring. She's been doing, she's a real deal. And she deserves everything she's accomplished within the industry. And I find it to be super cool that the fact that you've been able to do it for this long, in and out, but you've also carved that niche and you have that fly shop that I guess you and Evan are kind of working together on that. And how's he doing, by the way?
Did
you tell him I missed him?
You know, yeah, he's always great. He's always just, you know, he's the belle of the ball everywhere you go. But yeah, he's, you know, my name's on the door. if people are wondering what that name is, it says Larry's Fly and Supply. It's short for Hillary. Hi, Larry.
Yeah, so, I was gonna bring that up.
Yeah, so. It's very nerdy, and I just do things that I think are funny, regardless of, like, you know, any good constructive criticism from people who are like, no, you got to put Glacier in the name, or Montana, or, like, you know, Wild Rivers something, you know. But it's just Hi, Larry, Larry's Fly and Supply. But my partner Eben is he runs the show there, so he's slinging the guides around and keeping me in line. And I'm on the river all day, which is every day in the summer. I guide every day from May through October, and we don't have service. And so, like, you know, there's literally no cell phone service there, and I'm on a lot of overnights and multi-days. So, you know, I come out of the woods and it's like, what went on? You know, so he's got, and I don't know, like, what went on in my shop or whatever. It's more like in the world. And, you know, sometimes with, like, the kids, we've got three adult children, and they all work in fly fishing, and they're all kind of running their own programs too. And I come out of the woods and I'm like, everybody's lost their minds.
No, I love seeing that through social media, that you all are, you know, it looks like you're such a tight packed family, and it sounds like you're, you know, you guys are just kind of seeing each other as you go through the door, you know, coming in at night, going out.
Yeah.
But, it's really cool that you've really kind of sparked your daughter's interest in the outdoors, and now they're kind of following your footsteps. And I know that that's got to be super proud moment for you to be able to see that. And I know they're in college and moving forward. And I see one of your daughters heading, doing the show scene a little bit now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's Delaney. I think the cool thing is that they all do it their own way. Like you mentioned, following in my footsteps, but I don't really see it that way. And I think they don't either, because what we all do in fly fishing and in the outdoors is so different. And granted, they may be in it because of their exposure, you know, and just because of some of the opportunities that they've been given by just being on the water or traveling around with us, you know, and being around guides all the time, and just kind of that environment for sure influences them. And then also, because you're in that environment, whether you like it or not, you kind of learn it. It becomes a skill. Like they tried to, especially Ella, my oldest daughter, she tried to resist this skill her entire life. Like she would try not to get her guide's license until she realized that, well, she's already good at this, you know, so she might as well make money at it. But yeah, they've tried to, like, to have it not, I think, be the central part of their lives. And so what's cool is that they've been able to be independent and have separate lives, but still based around the river and the outdoor industry and fly fishing. So yes, Killian, Eben's on Killian, guides with me every day. He's an awesome whitewater fly fishing guide and multi-day guide. And he came up into the wilderness for the first time this year and crushed it. And I get to guide with him a lot. And then Ella, he's 24. Ella, the oldest girl, she's in college and graduating in December in sustainability. And she's a really great multi-day trip leader. So she's in charge of, like, if you go on a multi-day trip, somebody does the gear boat. So somebody packs all the food, plans all of the food, plans the trip. Like they have to get everything from the groover, you know, the toilet, to all the tents and tarps, and then all the, you know, kitchen equipment and all that stuff. She packs all that, and then she rows down herself and sets up camp, and then we come rolling in the evening with our clients, and she's got appetizers and cocktails ready and makes dinner and does all that, and then packs it up next day and goes to the next camp, that kind of thing. She does half day and full day whitewater too, but now she's you know, getting ready to graduate college, and she's kind of looking for what that means, you know. where do you work? Yeah, where do you work now? And then Delaney,
my daughter's the same deal. She's graduating in spring as well. So
is she kind of nervous about it?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, she's done extremely much better than I ever did in school, but she's still kind of not sure what her future is, even though she had a direct path and what she wanted to do. She just doesn't know what to do with it now, you know. Right. So we're having those conversations. So it's kind of still up in the air, but she definitely she definitely has been super focused throughout her college career on health and nutrition and trying to, and we spoke about this the other day too. It's like, as I get older and being a guide for so long, it's like my body feels it. And she's studied nutrition and she's been helping me with my diet and trying to keep me from getting older too fast. Right.
So yeah, no, like, I think what you said to me was like, you know, I mentioned, God, I'm trying to, I think I should cut down on some coffee. And you're like, oh, I'm on this mushroom coffee. And I'm like, what the hell? And you're like, yeah, not my idea. Not my idea. I know somebody who's a little like smarter about this. And it's when it's your kiddo, you're like, oh, dang, I'm learning from you now. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I see that, how that goes. But
she's definitely smart.
No, but I mean, but then you start to look at them in this different way as like peers. Like you had mentioned Delaney being at the show, she's working for Fish for Change. And so she's been traveling around to the consumer shows and working the booth there for Fish for Change. She's going to Costa Rica and Honduras. She's already been to Honduras and Bahamas, and she's just kind of, that's her own different path. But she's teaching me stuff about conservation and about the young people today in the fly fishing community that is so remarkable. And I think the biggest thing I'm learning about that, and this ties right into, I think, some other things we'll probably talk about today, is that some of these things in conservation, we as the old folks have had to learn, like maybe after 20 or 30 years of kind of being on the water. But these kids, it's been their whole lives. So they've been faced with these multiple different fisheries challenges in all corners of this country their entire lives. And we forget that's here we are like all fired up, like, oh, this shit's all messed up, blah, blah, blah. But this is their normal. Like they've had it their entire lives. So they really are in so many ways able to teach us a lot because they've been dealing with it since the very beginning. And I think they just don't always get listened to. You know, we make a lot of assumptions about these kids that, oh, they're just kids. Just kind of like, you know, when I was in my 20s, I don't know if anybody would ever listen to me because I didn't feel like I had anything to share. And so I think these kids have a lot to share and a lot of experiences that can help at a leadership level. And so to be able to see kind of like at Fish for Change, these younger kids step up and really drive, I think is really encouraging.
Hillary, let me ask you a question real quick.
Yeah.
And I guess it's a little bit biased and definitely drawing it from, you know, my own experiences. How much more profound did making a difference in conservation become for you when the kids came along?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you kind of, because with your level of experience,
mm-hmm.
Time wise,
mm-hmm.
You've probably seen the best and the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for me, reason why I'm asking the question is I have seen the collapse of fisheries that I enjoyed. And when we tell, you know, that Gen X generation, when I sit down and tell this younger generation of what we used to see and what it was like, I don't think they even believe us.
Right.
And it's that shifting baseline where we have to tell the stories,
mm-hmm.
and we have to tell them what it could be.
Yeah.
So they, because they've never seen it. I mean, so in other words, did the kids coming along accelerate your desire to make a difference?
Yeah. For starters, it terrified the hell out of me that maybe they would want to have jobs in this. Like I have, you know, I mean, it's like, oh, great. This is what I brought them into. And now they're going to start working in this and maybe have careers in this. And like, is that a good investment for any of us? You know, so I think that scary part is that, yeah, they do. They want to, because they see the giant value in it. It not just for their own, way of life and their own health, but also as a way of giving back. And I know that sounds very Pollyanna and very silly, but like, we don't have a lot to offer. You know, we don't have a lot of money. We don't have like a ton of generational wealth or like a lot, you know, but what we do have is an opportunity to share this place with people from all over the world. and to hopefully help be part of the solution. And so I only had that. I had that mentality very early on, just because the way I was raised, my parents are both in the National Park Service. My dad is the head of natural resources management. So I was raised to understand an intact ecosystem and cascading ecological effects, like our roles and responsibilities that we have out here. So it wasn't like you hear sometimes people have kids and they're like, oh shit, I better do something. You know, early on, like my parents were like, this is the rule. You don't get to pass go unless you put the resource first. So that was already kind of ingrained. I think where I felt like we could kick it into high gear was when I felt like we could be more of a team as guides, coast to coast, and experienced anglers, including our families and our kids who maybe wanted to be in it. And we weren't on an island and we weren't all alone. So that's kind of what kicked it into high gear for me as an adult. You know, as a kid, I always knew we had to, you know, we had to do nice things for the planet, you know, whatever it was. I mean, I remember as a kid, like, don't use too much toilet paper, or, you know, think little consciousness, you know, stuff like that. No mitten, don't make the mitten with the toilet paper was really important. But, and so that kind of grew into then as an adult going like, well, there's this huge overwhelming feel of like a feeling in your gut where it's like, no, this is too big. This is too much. And then that becomes relieved when you start to see there's people feeling the same way all across the country, and their guides and their fisher, their anglers, they're like outfitters and their shop owners. And suddenly you're not alone and everybody's got these issues, which then gets overwhelming again. So then what do? Well, you get a work together on it. Like you can be a team. And that's, I think, kind of what kicked it into high gear for me. So really, to answer your question, it wasn't so much that, oh, now I have kids, I have something to protect. It was that, yeah, I'm concerned that they want to be in this for a living, but I feel like we actually can do something coast to coast, kind of together, you know, as a global fishery.
I mean, we're all connected. I mean, we talked about that. That's a mission statement, really, for some of the things that we're doing together now, right? And we've spoke quite a bit about that recently, about how, and that leads me into this next topic, is like, you know, as a guide and the everyday changes or the yearly changes in the environment, it's like, you know, you have a unique stance and your fishery is still kind of intact. But I mean, I'm sure you're seeing expectations change from, you know, year to year, 30 years mm-hmm. of being there. I know 30 years for me, and we talked about this too, my fishery has completely changed. And that's one thing that ties into what you were just talking about with your kids and how they've kind of grown up in it. But for me, I kind of got to the last straw, and that's when I reached out to Tony about coming to work with ASGA and trying to have my voice be heard and the platform that I've created to try to make a difference, because my fishery, I mean, I have clients just like you do that's been fishing with me for most of my career. And there's certain fisheries here where I live now that they got to see during the heyday. And now it's like 20% of what it used to be. And they're like, you know, I love you to death, but I don't want to go do that anymore. Let's go find something else to go fish for, you know? So that's, for me, that's a big challenge. And to me also, and this is something else I want to talk about too, is as far as being a brand ambassador, there's unique challenges in that as well, like what's expected and whatnot, that I'd like to cover a little bit today. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could probably talk for hours, and yeah. I don't want to take too much of your time today, but I want to kind of talk about what you see as challenges going forward and your guiding and expectations on any given day, whether you have super experienced anglers or if you get more of the touristy type of clientele, or, you know, what is your clientele base like? And and how does that work, being that it's such a big operation there? Is it
right? Sure. And briefly going back to what Tony said about, do you ever talk to the kids about back in the day, or do you ever kind of think about how it was and whether it was a stronger fishery and more fish or bigger fish, or kind of like, was the water better or whatever it might've been? And, what I found is the scary part is that these may be the good old days, now, you know. So that's that, I think, also is what I've found with my kids and some of the younger guides, is they actually don't want to hear about the past or how it was, because there is a very, and this is gets real dark, but it's a very real reality that that's not coming back, that this may be what we can have now is what we're trying to protect. And it may not be as good as it was. And there's lots of reasons for that, because, you know, something as simple as development and how many people live in your fishery now compared to back then, there's just some things that aren't going to go back. There's not, you just can't put it back in the bottle. You know, it's already out. And so I think that the kids are kind of like, look, we can't just try to go back in time. What we have to do is try to protect what we have right now. And that just feels like how they feel. And maybe we can go back, but in a lot of fisheries that are native and wild, that could mean people might think that solution is stocking fish. And that's just not a solution for us here. We're in an intact ecosystem and we've got native and wild fish, and they're, you know, I will fight to the end, you know, when people think that the answer is just to put more zombie fish in the river. It's not the answer. And so I think it's healthy when kids are like, okay, let's protect what we have right now, instead of trying to go backwards, because it can be dangerous if you, you know, just try to fly too close to the sun sometimes. And so I that might be a little controversial, where people are like, no, you need to try to get it back how it was. But it's just, I don't
know. Hillary, I think you put it really well, you know, especially for your fishery and what you're, what y'all are facing now. I think that's because it is intact. Mm-hmm. I think keeping it the way it is enough. And I think you bring up a good point with the hatchery zombie fish, because that's been brought up for striped bass in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And it's also, it's actually started in a real small scale in Louisiana for redfish. And that's something that we vehemently oppose. Mm-hmm. For all the reasons that you would oppose it to. Every single one of them, and they're all valid. They're all very mm-hmm. valid, well thought out reasons and science based. But I think the only difference, and it's a critical one, in what we face in saltwater, is there's so many competing uses.
Sure.
So we have, you know, robust commercial fisheries, in some case, industrial, you know, bait fish extraction fisheries, and you know, to sit there and do what we do and speak for the resource. And there's legitimately, so y'all probably, you know, think there's tons of rivers out west that face, you know, when you put a monetary value on land and mm-hmm. then it's developed and you can't turn. We actually have drilled down and there's a monetary value on the fish. If there was a monetary value on your fish, it would be related to how much money it brings into the state. Mm-hmm. Through tourism and the jobs it creates and all the good things about keeping a healthy resource. For us, a lot of times a dead fish is money, and they don't understand the economic impact of catch and release. Mm-hmm. Not saying we don't all kill fish, but they don't, economists and managers can't wrap their head around that.
So then you compare how much each individual fish would cost to eat with what that fish alive is bringing into the economy.
Yeah. And it's tough. You know, it's saltwater fishermen are at least a generation behind freshwater fishermen. As far as conservation goes, with the exception of, you know, the bonefish tarpon permit mm-hmm. crowd. They get it that they've got a lot of struggles of their own, but they get it. But, you know, for us, it's like you have to stop the hemorrhaging mm-hmm. before you address the other issues. For us, it's how many are we killing? It's not, we don't even have time to focus on what good coastal development looks like, or, you know, how clean is the water? Like we're basically just putting our fingers like the little Dutch boy in the holes in the dike. Right. And, you know, every time someone calls us and says the fishery is in trouble, it's crisis management. And we can't even take a breath to look at the long-term issues that y'all are looking at.
Right.
You know, the important stuff that needs to be addressed. Like, we can't even put the little fires out that we're fighting to move forward on that level. It's tough.
Yeah.
But that's also where I feel like I have that connection, though. I mean, coming in, I mean, I live in the mountains, but do a lot in salt water. And I know Hillary does as well. And when I first started talking to Tony about doing this, you know, my big concern was, it's just like your film drop, right? Mm-hmm. So it all starts where we are, and everything shit rolls downhill, right? So it's like, if it's terrible here, it's sure as hell not going to be better when it gets to the coast. So, but I mean, but I have concerns on all fronts. I mean, we are fighting killing fish, but it's also, if we save them, what do they have to look forward to once we do save them? So, I mean, there's a big connection there with it. And, you know, ASGA and Tony, he's fighting that front, you know, he's on the fronts of saving fish. But I feel like there's another side of it where I want to kind of help out. Is like, you know, we've got to connect at all. Like, we're even where you live in Montana, you know, 1,000 miles from the ocean, right, or whatever. But it's all connected, and anything that happens up your way is going to affect what's going on down towards the coast. And that's a very important thing for us to focus on as well. And I know Tony, he's only got so many fights in him, but. I'm sure we'll figure something out.
You know, Hillary, you know what we've had to put an exclamation point and just to show you what y'all are saying is 100% right. We were looking at research that was just done on deep water corals. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, as far as the whole thing is connected. So these corals could be 4,000 to 8,000 years old. They don't grow very fast. And there's one area in particular off the Atlantic that they just discovered that is a deep sea coral bed that's the size of Yellowstone National Park.
Yeah, that's wild.
Largest in the world. And what the scientists figured out is that through the metabolic processes of these corals and the upwelling, is their life cycle, their breathing, their eating, it feeds the Sargasso weed in the Gulf Stream.
Yeah.
So you look at it and you're like, okay, so let me put this together for a second. This thing takes 4,000 to 8,000 years, its life cycle. Mm-hmm. And it feeds a key component of the entire ecosystem of the Atlantic Ocean. And we don't know anything about it. We just discovered it.
Right.
And how are we going to ruin it? Mm-hmm. So the whole ecosystem breaks down. Because that's my fear with anything that we do, is like, at some point, man is going to do something incredibly stupid.
Yes.
And well, do something point, just mean, enough to break that whole, I mean, real something really stupid and just break it. And we're going to be like, we can't fix it on a global scale. That's that kind of stuff keeps me up at night.
Yeah. I think walking softly sometimes is looked at as not having progress, or it's like, we can't have both these things. We can't take care of coral reefs or that we don't know about or whatever, and also have progress in the United States, you know, or also like better ourselves and grow our economy and things like that. It's not a yes and, it's an either or. And I think we're starting to learn that that's not the case. And I also think, like, when you talk about how are we going to mess it up or whatever, you think, gosh, nature is resilient and look what it has put up with so far. I mean, like, it is amazing that we have any corals sometimes when you look at what we've done, you know, I mean, if you really take a hard look at what we've done, this, that the planet keeps trying to bounce back and it keeps trying to help us. It keeps trying to give back to us. It keeps trying to give us food. It keeps trying to give us air and water and like a place to live. It keeps fighting for us, and we just keep kicking in the balls, you know. So it's like,
Blaine, how many times have I said that? If you just let it breathe,
right?
Like, if you just give it a freaking chance, let it breathe, it can come roaring back like we never imagined. But we're so arrogant mm-hmm. and so much hubris. And we think that we have the answer to everything. Right. And it's like, I'm just like, the answer is right there. Give it a chance.
Yeah.
Just give it a goddamn chance and you'll be surprised.
But yeah,
I'm an idealistic idiot. So.
No, it's true. Like, that's what I say. Sometimes I'm like, am I just too Pollyanna about this? But I think, like, it, you know, the planet isn't extra on the side. It's not like we live our lives and then, here's the Earth. It's like we're on it now. It's providing for us now. And so it seems like just a wee bit of reciprocity might go a long way for us in this next coming decades.
So what are you seeing? Are you seeing any changes that do you have to, like we talked about that as guides, right? Yeah. So let's go into that a little bit. I mean, there, I know you're seeing changes, whether it's not enough water or mm-hmm. bug life might be yeah. changing. I know that's a big topic out there now. And
yeah.
I mean, that in itself is really interesting and scary too. But like we just said, that nature is resilient, and you know, we just gotta figure out how to get out of the damn way to help it fix itself, yeah. right?
Well, but, one of the go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, but how does that affect your expectations as a guide, and are you seeing expectations change in your clients as over the years since you've been guiding them? I mean, it's, you know, I'm interested to hear your side of it, because I know what I see on my side of it.
So for starters, to answer that last part of your question about what are we seeing with clients, guests who are coming out here, is they're far more sophisticated about this area and about the ecosystem. Granted, I'm in Glacier National Park, and it's, you know, it's been heavily in the news just because of our diminishing glaciers. And so the people who are on the boat, I never have to get on a soapbox and start to talk about all of these things that are happening in this ecosystem. They already know, or at least they already know the questions to ask, and they expect me to have those answers. So something that I found in guiding is that the younger guides now, when they sign up for this, they know that's part of the program, is understanding their fishery at a scientific level and being able to offer more than, oh, it must be barometric pressure is why they're not eating today. You know, that shit we used to say, like when I first started, it was like, you didn't really know what was happening on there. You're just shoveling water. And pretty soon, you know, I came to learn, no, we do need to know more than just which bug to choose and where it cast over there, ma'am. You know, I think the young guides now, from what I found, especially with programs like Guiding for the Future that are really training these guides at a higher level in hydrology and entomology and intact ecosystems and the history of guiding, like manifest destiny and, like, you know, Native American presence and importance in these areas, is super high level. And that's really encouraging to me. And I found that clients are asking for that. You know, they're saying, like, you know, who are the first peoples here in this area? And guides, you know, are now, it's really important that we're talking about, you know, the Native American tribes who were here and who kind of led the way for some of these, you know, white guys to discover it or whatever, you know? So that's like not like some, you know, weird thing that is just brand new. These kids are really understanding this at a higher level than I ever did when I was younger. And so that's one thing that I'm really noticing in the difference of clientele, is that the sophistication of the questions that we're getting. And also, granted, that has a lot to do with our geography. People are coming here to learn. Glacier National Park is a huge outdoor classroom. So they're not coming here to go on, like, a, you know, roller coaster or water slide or whatever. They're coming here because there's a lot to learn. And they want that. So that's kind of one of the cool things. The impacts that we're seeing, or the changes that we're seeing, are really interesting, because, again, being a unique area and a unique fishery, we don't get to just talk about the changes to our fishery without addressing the bigger picture of where that change falls in to impacting the greater ecosystem. So, for example, a huge thing that we're experiencing up here as a result of climate change is hybridization of rainbows and cutthroats. So rainbow trout is non-native to this area at all, and it hasn't been up in this the top of this ecosystem, the crown of the continent ecosystem, which is this Glacier National Park area, because the rivers have been too cold. They're not really inhabitable for a fish like a rainbow that kind of like wants to be in warmer water. And so they were downriver in the main stem, close to Flathead Lake, kind of where there was a hatchery back in the day before we stopped hatcheries, late 70s, early 80s. And so they weren't coming up into the Glacier National Park area, which is the Three Forks of the Flathead. But now those waters are pretty warm. So it's like a, you know, now there's new real estate for them. And so the rainbows are coming up and we're having a hybridization increase. And, you know, this is this information that I'm getting is because since it is such a big outdoor classroom, we have direct line of communication to fish biologists from five agencies. So, you know, the anytime like Clint Mulfield over at the USGS writes a new white paper, you know, hey, I've got my radar on it and I'm reading all about it. And we're really lucky to have that information. But one of those is that this hybridization of rainbow and cutthroat could be a collapse of an intact ecosystem. And that really hits you hard when you realize, oh, it's just a freaking cutthroat. It's just our fish. It's just my the thing I play with every day. It's not. It could be the collapse of an intact ecosystem. Like that's mega, you know, that like blows my mind. And that really gives me a feeling like we have a greater responsibility than just, you know, flinging flies. And, you know, that's, that I think is kind of the biggest, one of the biggest things here is when you see that that change that has happened really could contribute to a greater problem, which then can contribute to a loss of even more jobs, you know, and kind of a whole collapse, not just of the ecosystem, but of our outdoor economy as well, you know, which is bananas. So that, and, you know, we also have, I know you hear all the chatter all the time about how we're always battling with our runoffs. And I know you do too. Like they can be so extreme. You and I were supposed to go musky fishing in your zone and you had that mega blowout. So we didn't get to, but here, a tricky thing that can happen is we've got snow, right? We're supposed to have snow. Well, because we're getting rain on snow events now, we don't just have snow in the winter and then rain in the spring and summer. We have unseasonable rain. So when we have a rain on snow event, it melts the snowpack way, way earlier. And then we're just like the praying for snow is like just to get a base. So when you hear these numbers that people are throwing around, they're like, you know, the Flathead's at 65% of snowpack. You're like, oh, that sounds okay. Like that's above, you know, 50% or whatever. Well, really, we need like 120% of snowpack to get us enough water to go throughout the summer. Because the next thing that happens is it gets so hot in June and in May when runoff is supposed to be kind of happening gradually, that we just get these blown out rivers that are doing a bunch of things. They're carving out habitat. It's straightening out banks and throwing debris down river. But it's also creating new foliage on the sides of the river. So you'll have new root systems from new trees because they've got all this moisture that then are sucking out even more water from the river. So then like by 4th of July, you know, we're in dire straits. We can tell we're not going to have the water that we need to last throughout the rest of the summer because of those really hot temperatures and big water that's causing, you know, trees to soak up even more water. And then also when we have these like unseasonable runoffs in the winter, or in the fall or in the early spring, then it's just tearing up the reds. So we could lose in the fall. You know, I think we're waiting on some white papers to come out about this, but looking at really the generations of bull trout that we could be losing because we've got a runoff happening over bull trout reds. And bull trout, you know, are protected species federally. And so here we are like, okay, maybe my clients aren't fishing for bull trout and we're not killing bull trout, but we're destroying their reds by having these unseasonable runoffs. So it's just these kind of...
What a cool fish, Hillary.
Yeah, right? Oh my God.
I mean, God, it's like some prehistoric monster trout eating like bully. Like sign me up. You know what I mean? Like that is like right. There's some just...
Yeah, no, they're fish. They're for sure my they're absolutely for sure my favorite fish. We don't target them here, but you can on the South Fork of the Flathead, you can get a catch card, and that is short season for targeting bull trout. And then we go up to Fernie in Canada a lot and fish for bull trout up there. But there's always like fly tires, like yourself, Blaine, or like I don't know. Actually, I don't know how much you personally debate this, but everybody's always talking about like if a bull trout eats the cutthroat from the head or from the tail, but I have seen everything. I mean, I mostly see them just like sideways, smack. You know, they do the thing where they bang them and then they come back and grab them. They will grab them anyway. I have seen tails coming out of bull trout. I have seen heads coming out of bull trout. I've seen heads and tails at the same time. I've seen them smush them like a banana and, you know, grab them from the middle. And they do not, they're not like, oh, I don't think I'll eat that because I'd have to get it head first or tail first. No, they will smash face.
Yeah. Welcome to my world. This is my lane speaking now. Yeah.
Love it.
So, yeah. And I haven't had a chance to target bull trout. So that's on my bucket list. So I've got a whole theory. We could go into that, but today's about you. So we'll just have to go bull trout fishing someday together.
Yes. I can smell the gears burning from here across the bay, Blaine. Blaine's like, Hillary, let me tell you, I have this idea. I'm designing a fly. And Rain Man comes out.
Yeah. No, I think he's probably like, actually, I know for sure they only eat them tail first.
but I do know they'll T-bone them. I know that's what they're going to, that's the main way of getting them.
For sure.
Especially if it's a larger fish. But I really want to do that someday. So I want to move on a little bit about, when you are doing this and you're seeing these changes, like the rainbow trout, so... I don't want to get away from that too much, but as an ambassador, mm-hmm. I mean, we both are ambassadors for some of the same teams, and I'm sure you feel the same way about this, but I feel like it's our responsibility as an ambassador to kind of lead the way, and we're kind of the canary in the coal mine too, which I've spoken about quite a bit, about how we can really echo what we see on mm-hmm. a daily basis and relay that to biologists. We could relay that to brands that we work with. How do you feel about that going into the future? And what do you think is important? I mean, one thing, we get to test equipment, which is super cool. I saw that Orvis just came out with the new Helios rod, and mm-hmm. you were a big part of that. And that was a really nice marketing thing that they did. But I mean, going back on the conservation side of things, I think it's the soapbox that we've created and our individual little areas. I think it's important moving forward that for me as an ambassador to use that voice to be able to kind of help make changes. And, mm-hmm. and I think you probably do the best at that looking at it from outside perspective, especially with your public speaking background and working in the news world and all that. I think you are a great voice for all of us. And I know as an ambassador for not just the brands, but you also work within the industry itself, and you work for some conservation co-ops as well. We can go into that a little bit too. I know Tony had some questions about that too. And I think we all kind of collaborate a little bit together on some of that, but within the fly fishing community, I know you're on some boards and whatnot, but I'm kind of jabbering on about this, and you could stop me at any point, but I do feel like there is an obligation for all of us right. that are in back, not to just show the fish and do the grip and grins and the coolest trip we've been on, but I think it's a responsibility of all of us to kind of highlight the problems that are out there and try to use our voices to help try to change some of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when I had mentioned it shouldn't be just that you go around your life and then, oh, let's like add in fisheries conservation and sustainability and the planet on the side, the best brands are already going to have that woven into the thread of their company. They're already going to have river protection and public land protection and you know, not just the big word conservation, but very specific preservation, management, very specific pieces of fisheries woven into their operation. And so then as an ambassador, you know, it's not like they sit you down and say, okay, like, so we're gonna have to have some product testing. Wouldn't it be great to do something with conservation and like maybe we can come up with some movie ideas or whatever. You know, conservation and rivers protection and, you know, habitat, all of these things are already woven into the grain of these big brands. And when I say the big brands, it's because, you know, we do know that conservation in general, in so many ways, is a privilege, you know, and protecting the planet is also a privilege. It's not just that, you know, that's not top priority to a lot of, you know, communities who are challenged, or especially people of color who are really like their circadian rhythms are off because they're having to live in factory areas, when we just, you know, are like, why don't you live by a river? Yeah, that would be really nice if we hadn't just been put in these zones. And so we know that that it is a privilege to be able to work on the environment.
Hillary, I just got to say one thing, that word, please don't stop. I don't want to interrupt you. That word privilege, when people ask our team at ASGA, like, what's the difference between you and other, you know, conservation, I'm doing air quotes for people who can't see me, other conservation organizations. And I use that word and I say, look, they think that fishing is a right.
Right.
They think that they were born in this country and that God, their grandfathers and their great grandfathers did this, and God provided this bounty for them to use at their will, and it's their right. And we believe it's a privilege.
Yeah.
And when you, you believe it's a privilege, you protect that privilege.
Yeah.
When you believe it's a right, I think you are more prone to abuse it and have it be a self motivation versus a privilege that you're like, this is all of us.
Yes.
Everyone should see this. Everyone should have this privilege.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I'm glad that you agree with that as well, because I also think, so fishing recreationally is a privilege, because you have to remember that, like, fishing in a lot of cultures is survival. Is actually protein, is actually needing to feed your families. And that's really important. And that sometimes our fun, our recreation can impact that cultural history, can impact opportunities for a lot of people, especially with gatekeeping and with just a lot of ways that we think we have a right to this river, or we think that it's our river or something like that, as opposed to having a really important cultural significance historically. So I do think we have to identify that privilege, but beyond the privilege of getting to fish recreationally is also the privilege of protecting that ecosystem, protecting that river. And a lot of times that takes money and that takes influence. And that's where I was saying, Blaine, those brands come in. So, you know, you might not find a startup fishing company is able to do as much or is able to help as much. They might just not have as much of the political will or cultural shift opportunities that a big brand like Yeti, Patagonia, Orvis, Costa, Scientific Anglers, Adipose, these guys really have, you know. And that influence, I think, is really important. And that's when we talk about, like, you know, influencers. I think that the brands, these big brands who are doing things, are really influencing. They really are influencing by showing the way. And it's not like this revolutionary, like, oh, I'm going to be the savior and come and like watch me do conservation. If it's built into the grain of that company, they're doing it for the right reasons. And they're also going to make money because it is the right, it's driving economies, saving the planet is driving economies. And it is, you'll never lose out. You will never lose out if you do the right thing for the right reasons. And so these big brands who you're talking about, Blaine, they're doing that. It's not extra. It's not like maybe they'll lose funding and they won't do it in 2 years. No, that's what tip of the spear is. They're already doing it. It's not going anywhere. And so ambassadors who are working with them, they already have to have that woven into their grain as well. Those brands aren't going to work with somebody who already doesn't do that without them asking them to. They're never going to. And not only that, like, you know, your coworkers and my coworkers at these brands, they never sent in a letter like hire me, or they didn't stop at the trade show and be like, look at my Instagram and you should hire me. They were sought after for their work on the rivers or on the ocean. They were sought after by these brands for the shit they're already doing, and they're doing it, and that makes them tip of the spear. So they're, you know, I can't think of anybody, Blaine, any of the ambassadors we work with who like sent in a whole bunch of like pitches and cover letters and like, you know, tried to sit at a, get a meeting at a trade show to get hired. The brands sought them out and probably fought over them. And the truth is those ambassadors were already using that brand's stuff because they believed in the ethos of that brand. Yeah, they have great products, but also because those ambassadors already use their stuff because they already believe in that ethos. They already believe that brand is doing the right thing for that fishery for the right reasons.
I agree 100%. And I mean, that's how it happened with me. I mean, I think we're in the same mold on a lot of stuff, but it's like, yeah, I'm just kind of floundering out there and doing my thing. And
yeah.
Next thing you know, you get an invite. It's like, oh shit.
Yeah.
I can't, as struggle as I might, I cannot imagine Blaine getting a one pager together.
Right.
It shows how many impressions he had on social media last year and like some kind of splash reel, you know, with a muskie T-boning a fly and be like, look at me. Like if people don't know Blaine, he's pretty introverted. You know, if you put him in a room with a bunch of people he doesn't know, not a real flashy individual. And as you were saying all that, I'm like, well, thank goodness that they approached it that way, or, you know, because Blaine's not a look at me kind of person. I know that from being his friend for a long time.
And a little advice to, you know, if any like kind of up and comers are listening to this and up and comers in the industry, you don't have to submit your one pager and your resume and look at my social media if you're already working to take care of your fishery, because that will be seen. Like that will be noticed. You will get credit for that because you're doing the work. And like anything, you have to go out there and do the work. And so, you know, I'm not saying go out there and do this work just so that you can get sponsored, whatever. But
it's more about your heart and why you're mm-hmm. doing it. And that shows. I mean, it's obvious when you see someone that's doing it for the gram mm-hmm. versus someone that's doing the real work, you know, and it's usually, you usually see it by the followers too. Right. So I do. I mean, you see some people that nobody's ever heard of that are really amazing badasses, you know, and that deserve anything that they get. Right. And then, and not taking away from those that are trying hard, but just doing it a different way. Mm-hmm. It's not taken away from that, but there's a difference, you know, and I don't know how to describe it, but you don't even have to.
It's genuine.
It's right. genuine.
It's genuine. Like either you are or you aren't.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've seen even at a river cleanup, I was at a river cleanup in another state. And, you know, when you go to a river cleanup, it's an all day thing. It's like hard work and it's gross and it's like, yeah. And so I've seen somebody come to a river cleanup and take a bunch of pictures and, you know, it's going on. And then I even saw one person like grab another garbage bag full from somebody else. I'm like, oh my gosh, look at how much stuff we got, and then leave. You know, I mean, it was all posted before the whole thing was even over. And that's a real thing that I've seen, just because they're like, okay, we know we have to do something for quote unquote conservation. We're going to hashtag conservation our face off, you know, and it can't just be that hashtag conservation. Conservation is such a weird word. You know, so it's like you can't just you fake going to a cleanup anymore. Like that just is not going to cut it. So and if you really care, then you will really do, and you will really, you know, be seen if that's what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. And if it's natural and genuine, you will organically mm-hmm. be found.
Yeah.
That's the trick. They will seek you out because mm-hmm. the brands are putting their power, their name, mm-hmm. their reputation behind an individual. Mm-hmm. So they better be genuine, right?
For sure. I get why people want to be found or sponsored or something, because if you're doing it for the right reasons, then it does give you some resources you didn't have before in terms of like going to Washington or, you know, having kind of a bigger audience to talk about saving your fishery. There's a lot of people who are genuine, as you say, about getting that kind of help from a big brand, you know, and I think that there's absolutely 100% nothing wrong with that. And truly using your social media platform to amplify messages from the brand and from your coworkers at that brand, and then also having that brand amplify your message about your fishery, I think is really a useful way that the brands can use their marketing dollars and their influence, and then vice versa from those ambassadors.
Cody quotes all the time, you know, the market research that he does, and it's the cutoff line is somewhere around, let's say, 30, 35. But people below that line make over 75% of their outdoor purchases on what the brand stands for.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, you know, ooh, I like that puffy coat.
Right.
Like they make their purchasing, and that, I don't think that's going to change. And I think as that generation ages, mm-hmm. and has more disposable income as they go through life, I think what you're going to see is more and more corporations looking at that and saying, we're missing the boat.
Yes.
Like we didn't, you know, and I think that's a positive trend in our world.
I agree. And I also think brands are getting, at least in the fly fishing industry, what I'm seeing, and from the AFTA level, you had mentioned AFTA, and just kind of seen from the eyes of the association and the American Fly Fishing Trade Association, is that a lot of brands are getting braver. They're not just trying to please everybody and make everybody a puffy. You know, they care about that ethos woven through, like I had mentioned about, and they're more willing to back it and not just please everybody. You know, for example, I mean, I remember back in the day when Orvis was kind of like a little like worried, because they're like, gosh, we do so much. Everybody doesn't know we do so much for conservation and so much for the planet. And should we tell people, you know, like, are we just going to be called like greenies or something, you know? And then that they were like, wait, no, we definitely need to go. Like, I remember when they did their first hill walk, and I was on it in Washington, D.C. About climate action. And that was, at first it was like, oh man, Tom's going to do a podcast and I'm really worried about the comments. That lasted for half a second. They did it. It's like, I think it's one of the most listened to podcasts that Tom did. He had Steve Hempkins on it. And it was really important. And that was a little bit of a sea change where they were like, no, we need to be proud of our conservation stance and our role and responsibility in this industry. And I think they haven't looked back. And it wasn't like, this is new to Orvis. They are the oldest, strongest conservation drivers within the fly fish industry for sure. And it was more just like making that brave in public and talking about it, especially at an ambassador level.
Hillary, what are your like, I kind of have like a Gantt chart in my head of like what we can get involved in. And we don't necessarily have to win it. Doesn't have to be a slam dunk. I mean, we fight the impossible fight. That's kind of part of our, you know, ethos. Like, but it has to matter, you know, to our members, obviously, the people that we're representing. And, it obviously has to be for good, you know, for the good of the resource, not just us. So like when I'm looking at something, there's a little bit of a decision matrix. If I pull the trigger, and when our anglers from Louisiana got in touch with us, I mean, I jumped on it like a fat kid on a cupcake, because it hit everything. You know, I was like, man, I've been waiting for y'all to call. Let's go. Like, let's go to yesterday. So what are those issues to you that you know you have to face next year and you would like to change for the better to make your fishery more sustainable in the long run? What are the just a couple of things off the top of your head?
Well, I think for starters, one of the things that saltwater anglers and guides can do is pay attention to other fisheries outside of your own. And I feel like that's already happening, but really it's happening in the West with Western trout anglers. We are obsessed with seeing what's going on in the salt. And it's because it is a bucket list for so many people, you know, not all Western trout anglers, like, you know, go in the wintertime to fish salt, but they want to, you know, they're really coveting it. They really want to catch a tarpon. They really want to go search for permit. They really want to see how many bonefish that they can catch, you know, before they can't. And so I think that reciprocity, like kind of that feeling of that saltwater guides and anglers also have your back in the West is really huge. And that's when we talk about those connected global fisheries, like Blaine was saying, that's when we really see that we've quote unquote won. So for example, I was down at the Captains for Clean Water Restore Gala this last winter. And at the industry summit, they put up a heat map that showed all over the country where people were coming from to give attention and money and engagement to Captains for Clean Water. So they showed that Captains for Clean Water, and specifically, you know, it's water issues in Southwest Florida, were really interesting to people in Montana, Alaska, Idaho, Wyoming, Maine, New Hampshire. It showed people all over the country were engaged in talking about the water and the you know, moving water south in Florida. So that was a really eye-opening thing to see that people, it's not just because they want to catch a tarpon or that they have caught a tarpon before. It's also because it sets a precedent for how to take care of your own fishery in your own area, and that somebody will have your back. And I don't know if ASGA has that same kind of heat map, if you can see where people are engaging from, but I bet it's similar. I imagine that, you know, you're going to see a lot of people in Montana caring about what you're doing. And I saw that for sure with the redfish fight in Louisiana, for sure. And I see it with the menhaden issues. I see it when we talk about oysters. I see it when we talk about the river of grass. I see it when we talk about steelhead up in the Northeast. If there was a heat map for each one of those issues, I think we would see people from all over the country caring about it and engaging in it. So to answer your question, you know, I think everybody has kind of heard about some of our issues with like some zombie trout in the Madison River Basin, the Jefferson River Basin. And so I think now it's one of the first times that I've seen people from all over the country kind of care about something that's just in, you know, could have been in quotations, just a trout back in the day. They know it's not just a trout now. And so, you know, Save Wild Trout is this newly formed organization meant to be for anglers from all over, even outside that Jefferson River Basin in Montana, who care about the precedent. And the precedent being, how can we prevent this from happening in our own area? How can we take care of it in our own area? And specifically with the Save Wild Trout situation, it's understanding our contribution and connection with our managing agencies. And I know this is something that you just write the book on over there, you know, with like dealing with agencies and how you can be part of the solution, how you can help, how you can not hinder, but how you can influence, how you can participate, and how you can show your agencies that you're paying attention and that you care and you're not here to get in the way. But, you know, we're out there every single day. So this is kind of one of those situations, too, where it's like, hey, look, we're in cooperation with Fish, Wildlife and Parks. We're in cooperation with it, whether it's the Forest Service or the Park Service or BLM, all these agencies have a job to do. And we're not 100% separate. You know, we're working on these rivers. We're driving the economy. We're bringing kids up through these systems as well. And we're electing Fish and Wildlife commissions, and we're electing governors who appoint, well, actually we're electing governors who appoint those commissions. And it's different in every state. And so I think just that acknowledgement, that we have a role, that it's not us versus them with those agencies, is something that Save Wild Trout is really setting stakes down on, is that like we do have an opportunity. So for example, in Save Wild Trout raised some money and is working with Fish, Wildlife and Parks on data. So save some money to be able to hire scientists and to be able to participate in kind of data collection to find out what the heck is going on with these fish. And I think that's kind of relatively new, but and can be scary. But it is totally possible, and scary just because you don't want to you don't want to hurt any processes that are already happening. You don't want to jump in if there's something we don't know, but it also helps in communication. It helps with agencies communicate to the public that when they know something or when they don't know something, to be honest about it, or when they need help, when they want people to raise money, when, you know, they need people to take samples. You know, we see these nonprofits and private organizations working on water sampling, like adventure scientists and science on the fly are becoming so much more prevalent. And that's because you have the public wanting to participate. So now the public, because you feel like, oh my God, I'm out here and I can't help. I'm out here every single day and I don't have a front row seat to talk to the Forest Service or Fish, Wildlife and Parks or the park or BLM or whoever it might be. And so you see these kind of other opportunities popping up, like those nonprofits, like that are doing high level testing of water, of soil, of algae, even, you know, in some cases of fish, you know, when it's under a really specific management situation. So that's one. And then I think, for me up here in Glacier National Park, really trying to understand public lands and intact ecosystems is something I would love for anglers across the country to think about. At least you don't have to totally understand it, but it is pretty unique and it is pretty important. So when you visit a place, it's finding out what is that unique thing about that place. What is the thing that sets it apart? You know, it's not just going to be big fish. It might be that this is one of the only places in the entire planet where you can catch a native wild black-spotted West Slope cutthroat trout in an intact ecosystem. Like that should be bucket list. That should be the check mark. You know, that's huge. So I think kind of that's one of the things we've got. I mean, like we've got all kinds of issues. Like we're, you know, in my town right now, we've got an defunct aluminum company that, you know, needs to get cleaned up by the EPA. And we've got a bunch of anglers who are constantly talking about that. We've got developers who are trying to run sewage under the river and to make, you know, big.
That's fine. I mean, it could be fine,
but when
sounds legit, it sounds legit to me. Like, I mean, if
nothing else, you're going to have better hatches in the future.
It's true. Yeah.
The phosphorus. Hillary, you were talking about, you know, catching this one fish in this one special place. And I was thinking, like, when you were talking about that, I was thinking a couple of years ago, we have this goofy little sunfish here. It's called a blue spotted sunfish. Mm-hmm. And it's about as they don't get more than like 5 inches long, but they're native and they grow in like these acidic little pothole ponds that we have over in the marsh. It's very specific and there's not very many places left. And I remember I probably walked through like good gravy, like a mile of marsh a couple of times. And I finally caught a couple and I got tore up by chiggers. I don't know if they got them out in Glacier National Park, but I can tell you if they do, stay the hell away from them. They are like, they come from Satan's armpit,
yes.
Right? Like they are the worst creatures. And it was, I was like,
keep going about the chiggers.
It's worth it. It was worth it. I'm telling you, it was worth it to catch a 5-inch sunfish. I'm telling you. So like we believe, Blaine named his damn dog Bowfin. You know what I mean? You're in the right crowd. You know, that resonates with us.
Yeah, for sure. No, I mean, one of the most precious things I've ever seen is like I fish with some big, strong, you know, outspoken Texans down in Texas. And the cutest thing is when they have like a little native Guadalupe bass, you know, and that they're bright green and they're just like tears in their eyes, like, oh my gosh, I caught it. You know, when they could be catching all of this big stuff, but having that native fish there or like a tiny cichlid, you know, they're like, this is so great because it's special, you know, or because they're in special water, you know, I just think that's the most precious thing. And it just shows you that is what matters. I love that. And to your point about the chiggers, we don't have here. I live in a utopia. We have nothing that bites or stings you except for grizzly bears and mountain lions. They will bite you.
Seems like a fair trade-off to somebody who lives with chiggers.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just saying, I'll stop talking about them. Blaine, I have a phobia for high grass in the summer. I will not. You could throw anything in there and I'd be like, I'll get it in the winter. Like, I'm not going.
We could get into black flies again, but
no, the no-see-ums. Blaine mummified himself in Louisiana last time we were there to avoid the no-see-ums.
That is a pro move. Again, to anybody out there who's like up and coming in this industry, it blows my mind when I see people wearing like almost no clothes. It doesn't have to do with like any kind of sexuality exploitation or anything like that. You know what I mean? It's because of the damn bugs. Like, I am covered because I'm not going to be bending down to scratch my ankles every 5 seconds because they are eating me raw. And that just comes from experience. Like, I'm going to be covered. Sometimes, like, if I want to wear shorts or lose some layers or whatever, I'm going to do it way out on the water, away from any kind of ground, because it is brutal. And I am one of those people too, where it's like, whatever blood type it is, I don't even know what blood type I am, but what there is a blood type. And it has to do with how much beer you drink too, is from what I understand, that makes you sweeter. And I am the sweetest of sweet, I'll tell you.
Did you hear what she just said?
I mean, drink Corona Light. So,
Blaine, I think we just learned something.
I gotta watch the calories, you know. So,
because like me, man, like generally they avoid me. I mean, I'm telling you, like that should tell you something about me. And I don't think it has to do with blood type. I think they bite me and they're like, and there's Blaine back there. You know, they generally. You know, mosquitoes, I could literally just be standing there. My friend could be covered head to toe. And I'm like, they don't bite me. Like, I don't know. I'm lucky. So, okay. We obviously learned a lot, you know, about the issues that you face, and you kept, you know, naming all these great organizations that are doing the absolute best they can in your region. And, you know, you were talking about those heat maps, and I wanted to get this in before we wound down, but, we've said this since the first day of the Guides Association. The fish may look a little different. All our problems are the same. We've tried to teach policy 101. Like, how do you reach out to an elected official? How do you develop a relationship with the state agency, with bureaucrats, with managers, state, local, regional, federal, everything? Because I think you don't strike me as this, and I know Blaine is not this type of person. You don't strike me like this at all, but you know, all those people that are like, my legacy. And I'm like, boy, aren't you worried about yourself a lot? Like, I spend my life aggravating people. Like, my legacy is going to be like, thank God that guy's dead. You know, he stopped bothering us. But I think if there was one legacy that I'd like to leave behind, you know, it's vis-a-vis the Guides Association, is that we taught a lot of people how to be good advocates, because they will teach more people and more people and more people. And you know, I think it's not a legacy. Blaine and I always say this on the podcast, is like, you know, we stand on the shoulders of the people that came before us. Like, we didn't invent the wheel, you know. Yeah. We're part of a greater, you know, for lack of a better word, a coaching tree. You know, who did this person begat this person and begat this person and begat that person. And we have a responsibility to protect that privilege, you know, of fishing and all that kind of stuff. Sure. But I think you touched on something that's just integral. If we ever want to save anything, we can't do it alone. We have to create kind of that countrywide and then global conservation community that can lean on each other and teach each other the lessons learned. And then those next folks are 10 steps ahead of where we were when we started, right? That's the dream. I mean, that was my dream with the Guides Association from the first day.
Oh, that's great. Well, I think that piece about teaching people about how to speak to our elected leadership is so key. And for me personally, years ago, when I realized that was an important way, I couldn't find anything within the fly fishing industry. And this is, you know, over a decade ago, really digging for that. And I knew it had to exist, but I couldn't find specifically somebody who could teach me you know, how to speak to my elected leadership. Somebody, I could see people training the trainers, or somebody who maybe is teaching CEOs, or so maybe somebody is teaching like the head of a nonprofit or something like that. But I couldn't find how just anglers could, or guides could, learn how to talk to their elected leadership. But yet at the same time, we started seeing all of these organizations saying like, call your senator, or call, you know, go to Washington, or do all these things. And I was like, there's just really got to be a way. So that's when I reached out to Protect Our Winters, and Protect Our Winters trains professional snowboarders and skiers on how to speak to their elected leadership. And they were really effective. They are really effective. And so I went and talked to Jeremy Jones, the founder, and he was like, yeah, we, of course, we'll help just, you know, professional fly fishermen, not just professional skiers and snowboarders. And then they opened it up to like professional climbers, Jimmy Chin and Conrad Anker, and then mountain bikers like Rebecca Rush, and like all these people who I really looked up to. And they were all looking for the same thing, somebody to really be able to train professional athletes on how to go to Washington, or go to Helena, their state capital, go to Tallahassee, for example. And then I think we started seeing more organizations really go, okay, like this is something that we can, I think they're already doing, but they weren't making it available to people like me. And I think it is now. So I'm seeing it at AFTA, at the American Fly Fishing Trade Association, especially through the AFTA Fisheries Fund. I'm seeing it at Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, which is awesome. I'm seeing it at American Rivers and the Northern Rockies River Council. I'm for sure seeing it at their Fly Fishing Outfitters Association of Montana, and specifically that Guiding for the Future program that I told you about. And I think that it's really important, like just kind of what you talked about and what you're doing is, in terms of a legacy, that's very literal. Because when you teach somebody, then they know, and then they're going to teach somebody, and then they know, and they, you know, it's not like you just built this legacy. It really happens like a ripple effect. And I think that that is a huge thing the ASGA does, that is for sure an important legacy.
That's all amazing stuff. You know, there's so many things that we go back and forth over, you know, on our short conversations. We've been talking a little bit more lately, but all that stuff resonates. I mean, Tony and I talk about it all the time. I mean, I've talked about it with a lot of my mentors and the legacies that we do leave, and it's true. And everything that you said, I couldn't agree more with. I know Tony agrees. We've talked about this a lot behind the scenes and whatnot. That's one reason that I'm where I am with ASGA. And I know that's where you are with Protect Your Winters. I'm sure there's a lot more other organizations that you're with that I'm not aware of, but I know there's a reason you are where you are within the industry and the platform that you've created, and why I'm such a fan of what you do, because you are a leader in the community of not just fly fishing, but fishing in general. And we need more people like you. And I greatly appreciate your time today and taking that time out. I hope we can maybe talk about more stuff in the future and do more things. I know we're going to do some stuff together. Hopefully we can get on some fishing trips. And
heck yeah.
Well, Hillary, remember this. If y'all ever need to get the word out about something, and clearly you have more connections, you know, than a jigsaw puzzle, and much more than we have in the fishing industry. But if we can ever help you facilitate getting the word out, help you on any issue, that door is wide open and will remain open, and it'll only take a text to Blaine, and we can throw our help into that as well. And I'm super grateful that you took the time. Thank goodness we caught you in the winter when it could either be raining or 40 below.
Well, I always tell people that the pendulum is always swinging. Like right now, the big pendulum in life is like, I'm at a point right now where I'm like an empty nester. Kids are all grown and gone in the winter. They'll come back in the summer. But like, this is a good thing for people to think about in terms of how and when they can serve. So, you know, I am on a bunch of boards right now. And that might seem like a lot, but it's not, it hasn't always been that way. And it's not always going to be that way. You know, the pendulum swinging. And right now is a time for action. It's really an important kind of time in fisheries and with a lot of environmental challenges that are going on. And so it was the right time for me to be on a bunch of these boards. And that's kind of like all I have to offer. I don't have, like I said, I don't have a lot of other resources personally. So being able to offer that time is huge. And I'd love to see as many people as they can kind of go out for some of those. Like just a little pitch to get people to maybe look around and join some of these boards, but like the American Fly Fishing Trade Association for sure. And then the AFTA Fisheries Fund is connected, but also separate. And then Protect Our Winters, I'm on the board of that, and Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. And then at American Rivers, there's regional advisory groups for each one of those. And then the same thing for ASGA. I think we are they, you know, and so if people can just remember that they are ASGA or they are some of these other nonprofits, that's how the cog turns, you know. So it's like I think that just a little plug for people to kind of not feel guilty if you don't have time, because there's lots of times I don't have time. There's lots of seasons in my life when there's no way I'm going to be on a board, and there were times in the past when my kids were young that there was no way I would have time for any of this. But if you don't blame, and also don't you know, shame people for not being on boards or for not serving, because there's always going to be a time. But look at your own time and be like, is this the time? And if not, no biggie, don't feel bad about it and don't hate on yourself. But maybe there will be a time to do it in the future.
It's great words by the great Hillary Hutchinson.
My brother.
Right? Definitely. No, man. Big fan. And I'm just sitting back and listening. I mean, it's you've got a lot of unbelievable things to say, and it's been a pleasure watching your career over the past, I don't know, 20 years, I guess.
Thanks, man.
At least something like that.
Well, we just got to go get you some bull trout. We'll go up to Canada and have at it. I mean, just so you know, the game changer works there.
Yeah, perfect. Well, you know, I'm actually heading to Montana now. I am actually heading to Montana this year for the first time. I've never been there. So,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
Well, a river does run through it, so you're going to do just fine.
Yeah. Why do I have a feeling that Blaine's going to come back with a story about mountain lions and bears?
Oh yeah.
There's something.
If you come up in wherever you're going, I'm sure you're going to like Southwest Montana and catch some big brown trout. But if you come up north, then I will put you through the ringer. I always like it when I have one of my friends come, because like, you know, I'll make you row whitewater, make you kind of go through the whole lions, tigers, and bears, oh my, scene. You'll love it.
Sounds good. You had me. Well, well, Tony, I think we had one of the best podcasts ever, man. So
I agree. I think our guest is super relatable. Across, it doesn't really matter if the water's salt or fresh. I think the message resonates across all spectrums. And it's my takeaway from Hillary's time with us is that, you know, you fight for what you love in whatever capacity that you can fight on that given day. And then you wake up and you try to do it again. Mm-hmm. And we all got to stick together. Those are the two takeaways. And all I can say is I appreciate everyone listening to our podcast. I'm still amazed that y'all can get through my bumbling and stumbling. Thank God we have good guests. We had one of the best on today. And if there's any questions or comments, or, you know, somebody wants to help Hillary up in the area where she is, you know, this beautiful intact ecosystem, just send a message to comments at saltwaterguidesassociation.org. We'll be happy to answer them. And if we can't, we'll absolutely send them to Hillary. Thanks everyone for listening. And we sincerely appreciate everyone's time, especially Hillary's.
Yeah. You guys, thank you so much. Thanks for what you're doing and taking all this time to get out there. I think it matters and I really appreciate it. So thank you.